Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome once again to the program that helps you learn American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Many of you write to us and ask for more stories about the United States. Today, you are in luck. We have two things to tell you about. The first concerns what and where Americans eat. One of the world's best-known restaurants has some serious competition. Then we traveled to the southeastern state of North Carolina to hear about three young students who lost their lives to what some believe was a hate crime. The news may be good or it may be bad, but we will always bring it to you as it is. Now, here is Ann Ball with our story on food and eating habits in America.
Plain cheeseburger. Give me two of them.
That is Ted Mistretta, ordering food in Washington, D.C., before boarding a train with his daughter, Kim. They were heading home to New York City. But first, they stopped at the Shake Shack restaurant to get a bite to eat.
Any fries, anything to drink?
No. Are you dining in or to go?
Shake Shack is a new kind of restaurant becoming more popular in the U.S. The restaurants are not fast food. They are known as fast casual. Observers say Americans want more choices and fresh food when choosing where and what to eat. This trend is one reason why the fast food restaurant McDonald's has struggled financially. McDonald's is one of the best-known restaurants in the U.S. and even around the world. Their ads say, "I'm loving it," but these days the company leaders are seeing numbers they probably do not like. In the last quarter of 2014, McDonald's net income dropped by about $300 million. The January earnings report brought more bad news. Worldwide sales dropped for the eighth month in a row, and even more than expected. McDonald's is working hard to get their customers back. In January, the company ran an advertisement during the Super Bowl. The football game is the most watched TV event every year in the U.S. McDonald's wanted to reach those viewers. While McDonald's is struggling to get their customers back, Shake Shack is doing well financially. The New York-based burger chain had a very successful IPO, or initial public offering, of shares at the end of January. On its first day of trading, Shake Shack went from $21 a share to just under $46 a share. Ted Mistretta wishes he had bought the stock that day. He explains why he likes Shake Shack.
It's a quality hamburger. It's they make it well. Great taste. It's better than most. It's certainly better than, it's fast food, but not fast food food.
And Mr. Mistretta added he never goes to fast food restaurants. Being part of the fast casual trend has helped Shake Shack. Other fast casual restaurants in the U.S. include Chipotle and Panera. Bonnie Riggs is a restaurant expert with NPD. She has followed Americans' restaurant habits for almost 30 years. She says one reason Americans like fast casual food is because it's new.
They're creative, they're innovative, there's something different, and we like to try new things.
Ms. Riggs says Americans made 61 billion visits to restaurants last year. 3 out of 4 visits were to fast food restaurants like McDonald's. They're holding on, she says, but traffic has stayed at the same level. Fast casual is still a small percentage of restaurant visits. She says it's growing by leaps and bounds because they meet consumers' needs.
They know it's being prepared while they wait. It's fresh ingredients, quality food, good tasting food at what they say are reasonable and affordable prices.
Many Americans still like their fast food, Ms. Riggs says. They're just not going as often. And, she says, Americans are finding other ways to have a meal. Some people buy prepared foods at stores and take them home to eat. Others like to cook at home, especially the millennials. Millennials are people born between 1981 and 2000. And this year, they are expected to become the largest group of Americans. Ms. Riggs says that half of this generation is cooking at home and loving it. Some of the new eating trends include farm-to-table restaurants and gluten-free food. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Now we have a very different kind of American story. You may have heard about the deaths of 3 students recently in the state of North Carolina. They were killed on February 10th in what some people suspect was a hate crime because they were Muslims. Musarut Jabin is head of the Al-Imam School in Raleigh, North Carolina. She knew the 3 young people, Yusor Abu Salha, Dia Barakat, and Razan Abu Salha. They were 23, 21, and 19 years old. Dia and Yusor were recently married. Yusor and Razan were sisters. Their former teacher, Sister Jabin, says the young people were always trying to do good deeds. Kelly Jean Kelly tells us more.
Dia Barakat was studying at the University of North Carolina. He was hoping to become a dentist, a doctor who cares for people's mouth and teeth. He even started a campaign to provide dental care to Syrian refugee children.
Have you ever felt helpless about the situation in Syria and felt like you can't do anything about it? Well, this is your opportunity to help.
Sister Jabin says she hopes people remember Dia for the good he did.
He had a cause in his mind. He had a mission in his mind.
Sister Jabin says all 3 shooting victims wanted to help their communities and their school. She says Razan Abu Salah assisted with a Saturday class on the Quran.
So that by itself shows how much volunteerism was in her as a young lady.
Sister Jabin says Razan's older sister, Yusor, was very mature for her age and a very happy person.
Very polite, very gentle.
Sister Jabin says Dia, Yusor, and Razan were all caring, helpful people.
All kids are wonderful, you know, but there are some, they're just outstanding. We need more people like that, and that's what I say, that it's now more challenging for me. That's a goal for me, to have more Dias and more Yusors and more Razans.
A neighbor is charged with killing the young people. Police say the murders may be related to a parking dispute. But some activists are asking officials to investigate the murders as a hate crime because the victims were Muslim. Officials have not yet said how they will consider the case. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to The Voice of America. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. Most West Coast ports in the United States have been busy since Friday. That is when negotiators reached a tentative settlement in a 9-month labor dispute and work slowdown. Now that goods again are being unloaded, the dock workers and employers say they can talk about long-term problems. Many ships have been docked or have been waiting offshore at 29 West Coast ports. Port officials say it will take months to process all the cargo. Most dock workers have returned to work, but they still must vote on a tentative 5-year contract. U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez went to San Francisco to urge both sides to settle their differences quickly. Craig Merrilies is with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. He said the negotiations have been difficult.
You know, there were a lot of tough issues in this process that lasted over 9 months, and some of them are the kinds of issues that are affecting all workers. That includes the outsourcing of good jobs.
Workers say administrative jobs at the port have been moving to other states and other countries. Workers say they also worry about increasing automation of port operations, reducing the need for workers. Those who move goods in and out of the country include the San Francisco Coffee Company, Ritual Coffee Roasters. Eileen Rinaldi is the owner.
We are reliant on constant arrivals of coffee in order to have a fresh supply.
Many other businesses depend on goods passing through the ports, such as beer makers that use imported hops, farmers with crops to ship. One California children's clothing company has been waiting for its products trapped in ships near the port of Oakland. Tom O'Brien is a transportation expert at California State University, Long Beach. He says long-term problems at the ports must be addressed.
The fact that we have larger ships coming in now that's creating peak demand for labor and for equipment is putting a lot of pressure on our infrastructure. Not only the ports, but the road network, rail capacity, distribution center, and warehousing.
Mr. O'Brien also says not only the ports, but roads, bridges, and railways need to be upgraded. The labor dispute began in July when a labor agreement ended. The work stoppage has affected 29 West Coast ports for months and slowed U.S. trade with Asia. Those ports process more than 25% of all U.S. maritime trade and more than 70% of the nation's imports from Asia. And that's the Economics Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Grover Cleveland was elected President of the United States in 1884. He was the first Democratic Party candidate to win a presidential election in almost 28 years. Grover Cleveland defeated James Blaine, a senator from the Republican Party. The election was very close. Many Republicans did not vote for their own candidate. They voted for Cleveland instead. They believed he was honest and that Blaine was not. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidency of Grover Cleveland.
Cleveland began his administration by announcing that he would reduce waste in the government. He would make government more like business. He said he would support reforms to let ability, not politics, decide who would get government jobs. Democratic Party leaders were quick to protest. They explained to Cleveland that the party owed jobs to those who had worked for his victory. Cleveland had to compromise. He permitted about 80,000 government jobs to be taken from Republicans and given to Democrats. This left 12,000 jobs. These would be given to people who did the best on government examinations. Cleveland's decision angered Republican reformers who had voted for him. They accused him of surrendering to the leaders of the Democratic Party.
On other issues, however, Cleveland refused to compromise. He opposed government economic aid to any industrial group. He vetoed a bill giving aid to farmers whose crops had failed. And he vetoed another bill giving more money to men who had served as soldiers during America's Civil War of the 1860s. The president also showed his independence by investigating gifts of public land that the government had made to the railroad, wood, and cattle industries. He found that many of these land grants were made illegally. He got back much of the land. He opened it to settlers.
President Cleveland signed into law two bills he believed would improve government. One was the Electoral Count Act. It set new rules for counting the electoral votes of the states. It would prevent future disputes over presidential elections, like the one in 1876. The other bill changed the list of officials who could become president if the president and vice president died or were removed from office. First on the list, after the vice president, was the Secretary of State. Congress changed this law again in 1947, and there have been four amendments since then. Today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives would succeed the Vice President as President. Then would come the President pro tempore of the Senate, and then the Secretary of State.
Grover Cleveland approved a bill giving the government control over the cost of railroad transportation. The bill was called the Interstate Commerce Act. It limited the amount of money railroads could demand from people who needed to travel or transport their goods. The law established the idea that the government could control industries when necessary for the public good. President Cleveland also was concerned about a growing number of labor disputes that took place in the United States in the late 1800s. He proposed that Congress create a labor committee to help settle the disputes.
Congress failed to act on this proposal, but its lack of action did not stop the rise of a labor organization that had been formed a few years earlier. The group soon would become the most important labor union in the United States. It was the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. Led by Samuel Gompers, the AFL was different from earlier labor groups. It did not try to put all workers into one union. Instead, it tied together a number of different unions and gave them general leadership.
The AFL was different in other ways. It did not oppose the economic system of capitalism. It said only that labor should get more of the earnings of capitalism. The AFL also opposed extremists who used labor protests to change the social system. What the AFL called for were things workers wanted immediately: higher wages, a shorter work day, better working conditions. One of its first demands was an 8-hour work day. This demand led to a number of strikes and protests throughout the country.
The most serious incident took place in Chicago's Haymarket Square. More than 1,000 union supporters went to a meeting there, organized by an extremist. They stood calmly and listened to speeches. Just before the meeting ended, someone threw a bomb into a group of policemen. The bomb exploded with a blinding flash. 7 policemen were killed. The other policemen began shooting at the crowd. Some people in the crowd fired back. When it was all over, 10 persons had been shot to death. 50 others were hurt. The incident set off a wave of fear and anger across the country. The public demanded action against union extremists. The Haymarket Square violence slowed the growth of organized labor in the United States for many years. It would be some time before labor became a powerful force in national events.
In the spring of 1886, President Cleveland announced that he was to be married. The ceremony took place in the White House. A few months later, President Cleveland and the First Lady went to New York City for the official ceremony welcoming the Statue of Liberty. The statue was a gift to the people of the United States from the people of France. It represented the alliance between their two countries during America's war for independence from Britain. The statue was the creation of French artist Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. He decided to make a statue that would represent freedom, a statue of liberty. He said it should stand on an island in New York Harbor. There, he said, it would welcome all who came to America through that gateway.
Bartholdi decided to make a copper statue in the image of a woman, Lady Liberty. High above her head, she would hold a torch of freedom to light the world. The statue's face was the face of Bartholdi's mother. The artist asked French engineer Gustave Eiffel to build a steel support to hold the heavy statue. Eiffel was the man who later built the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The statue was built in France. Then the pieces were sent across the Atlantic Ocean. It was rebuilt in New York.
Grover Cleveland and his wife were not the only Americans to attend the Statue of Liberty ceremonies in 1886. Thousands of people crowded onto ships in the harbor to watch the great event. Thousands of others crowded the shorelines around the harbor. Everyone cheered wildly when a signal was given and a huge cloth fell from the statue. Lady Liberty stood holding her torch high for freedom. Under her feet were the broken chains of tyranny. Below the statue was a poem. It called to the poor and oppressed people of the world. It told them to come to America to find a land of hope and freedom.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
The Statue of Liberty was a great success. It was one of the great engineering wonders of its time, and it filled Americans with pride in their tradition of freedom and openness to people from all lands. We will continue our story next week.
Our program was written. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.